listening to the Building Heroes podcast, which stands for Building Healthy, Energy Efficient, and Resilient Occupants as an educational series. The Building Heroes podcast is proudly sponsored by Better Bricks and was created to help bridge the informational gaps that can occur between industry, academia, and experts in the industry doing this kind of work every single day. This podcast varies in topics per quarter and per year, generally featuring voices of industry experts and thought leaders in the fields of construction, design, technology, specialty trades, and skilled trades, as well as those who work in the humanities, energy efficiency, social science, and policy. If you want to learn more about Better Bricks, you can find them online at betterbricks.com, a commercial resource for energy efficiency. So I am joined here today with Damon Woods from the University of Idaho in Boise. Damon, would you like to introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about your background?
Sure. Yeah, thanks for having me on here, Shelby. I really appreciate it. I came to the University of Idaho Integrated Design Lab over 10 years ago now, back in 2012. I had developed a passion for energy efficiency during grad school at Boise State. I started out studying mechanical engineering at Montana State, kind of focused on aerospace, was interested in renewables, and then I started my master's at Boise State University, looking at wind energy and hydrokinetic energy. And during that time, I just developed a really big passion for energy efficiency and the world of energy, and realizing that buildings use so much energy, it seemed like, oh, I'd really like to focus there. And I went to the director of IDL Boise. At the time, it was Kevin Venden, Y. Mellenberg. I'm like, I'd really love a job here. It's like, well, we either hire students or professors. So do you want to get a PhD? And I said, not really, but if that's what I have to do, then I'll do that. That's where I got to meet Julia, because she was there at the time, which was great. And I've been there ever since. I finished my PhD and then kind of switched to the other side of the lectern, served there as a research scientist, and eventually became director there. And it's a job that is full of great things, stressful things, a lot of moving parts. And it's all about, yeah, buildings and energy, which initially I think I had thought when I was an undergrad would be very boring, but now I find it to be one of the most exciting design spaces and places to develop new ideas in the engineering world.
And now you're also a faculty with U of I, is that correct?
I am, yes. I'm a research associate professor there. So I do a little bit of teaching. I'll be teaching environmental control systems, but primarily, I'd say 90% of my time is spent doing research.
Awesome. That's really cool. And it's nice to know, like, I know Julia was there for a certain period of time in her career, and you have a little bit of overlap there. When you were a student, like, what kind of work were you actually doing? And can you explain, like, a few projects maybe that kind of led you to where you are today?
Yeah. So I'm a skinny person, and I'm constantly cold in places, and it really bothers me.
I run cold, and people give me so much flack for it.
Yeah, Julia could sympathize. She and I were both sitting next to a very cold window when we were working there. And like I said, you know, buildings use, you know, the largest amount of energy of any sector in the U.S. And if you break that down further, the biggest energy use in buildings is HVAC. And what is HVAC for? It's keeping people comfortable. So that's really what I wanted to target. If we're going after saving energy, reducing our emissions, reducing expenses on energy, then why not go after the biggest energy user in the biggest energy sector, which is HVAC and buildings. So I looked at radiant heating and cooling, which is very effective. You know, it's a uses a dedicated outside air system. So you're separating your heating and cooling from your ventilation. It's very efficient, and it can keep people more comfortable, but they can be difficult to control. So I did a lot of energy modeling. And paired some of those energy models, kind of creating a digital twin of a building, and then paired it with a weather forecast. So you could see if there was, a heat wave coming in or a cold front moving in, then how could you pre-cool or preheat the surfaces of the building so that people would be very comfortable without spiking the energy use. And so I've kind of stayed in the energy modeling world and kind of on the thermal side of things. So I'm hired as a research associate professor of architecture, having not taken an architecture class. So hopefully my dean is okay with me saying that on the podcast. But my background's all in mechanical engineering. So I really focus on primarily the HVAC systems in buildings and trying to keep people comfortable, including myself.
Yeah, the mechanical focus, I'm sure, especially in the design and construction field, maybe being a little bit less technical, you really truly understand like the nuts and the bolts and the guts of what makes a building work, which is what makes a building work, right? Like understanding
Right.
that fundamentally, I'm sure gives you an upper hand when you're working with design students who, for better or worse, may be a little up in the clouds.
Yeah, no, I love that aspect of teaching. And I was just at a conference last week and they were talking about AI. It was the dean of the architecture school at Yale, and he said AI is great at creating images of buildings, but it's not a real building. And if you're an undergraduate student, you might think I've drawn this beautiful space, and that's great. It's a beautiful piece of art, but it's not something real that you can inhabit. And until you do, and until you actually think about keeping people comfortable in that space, it remains a piece of art rather than a functional building. So trying to make sure that I tell them like, okay, well, you're gonna have to keep this, heated or cooled, and people still need air to breathe. So I know you've got these very clean open spaces, but where is that airflow coming from? Where is it going to? How are you keeping this space comfortable is something that I try to really emphasize in some of the classes.
Yeah, and to that point of an AI building not really being an occupiable building, it's also not illustrating what it takes to build that
Right.
building, right? And all of the very complicated and oftentimes, maybe not messy is the right word, but the overlap of all of these different trades and the coordination that it takes in order to make a building occupiable but also functional, right?
Right. Yeah, the analogy that I'm going to try to use this fall is that the mechanical systems and the electrical systems, they're almost like a joint. If you had like two pieces of wood, like yes, you can just put in some wood glue and a couple of screws and it's going to be really ugly to make that joint work. But an integrated design is more like Japanese joinery. Right, where the mechanical and the electrical and the plumbing all fits within the fabric of the building to create a beautiful space, almost so that you don't even notice it, right? And it becomes seamless. That's what I hope the students can get to.
Yeah, and you led us right into the point of this conversation, the integration of buildings and the integration of design and construction and buildings. Do you want to introduce the Integrated Design Lab at UI Boise?
Yeah. So the U of I Integrated Design Lab, it's gone through a few different changes as we've had different directors. So we were founded by Kevin Van Den Wymelenburg. He was our first director. And he and Chris Meek at the UW Lab, they really had this amazing focus on lighting, natural light in buildings, what these spaces are going to look like, combating glare. After Kevin left, our next director was Elizabeth Cooper, and she came from a health background, as well as architecture. So she was really focused on indoor air quality and indoor environmental quality. And then when she went on to pursue her own PhD, we had Ken Baker come in, who has done so much education and work with NEA on energy codes. And after he retired, he asked me to step in, and I'm some sort of hybrid of all of those that have come before, right? So, differentiates U of I's IDL as from the others. I'd say that we do a little bit of everything. Our strongest focus lately has been on, because it's, undermined, like the thermal performance of buildings. And doing a lot of energy audits. So going out to rural schools to help identify things that are going to be particularly cost effective. The other thing that makes U of I IDL unique is that we're in Idaho, right? That kind of goes without saying. But Idaho has a very specific climate. And I'm not talking about just climate zone, I'm talking about political climate. It's a very conservative state. And so things like embodied carbon and carbon emissions are lower on the priority list for some of the clients that we deal with. What is high is making sure people are comfortable, the spaces are well lit, and particularly economics. So we do a lot of economic analysis using energy models to predict what the return on investment might be from different design changes. So working with both the architect and the engineer and the owner to kind of create a shopping list of here's some different efficiency options. How can, we combine a couple of these so that, looking at the next 20 years of your energy bills, you're saving money over time by, making this adjustment upfront.
Yeah, and sidebar that this would hopefully be mentioned in that pre-recorded snippet that Julie and I are going to do on the history of the labs. But, with all of the integrated design labs, ours, the integrated design and construction lab, because we wanted to be different, each have their own specialty. They're in different states. We have two in Washington, one in Oregon, one in Montana, one in Idaho. How would you say the political or otherwise, actual climate, physical climate differs from the work that even us in a also conservative politically area might be from UW's operations today?
Yeah, I think where I notice the difference the most is probably when it comes to energy codes. And it's work that I really enjoy. Ken Baker had a great phrase that he would use that he wanted energy codes to be progressively effective and that they're clear, and they're easy to implement. They save energy. That's the progressive part, not progressive liberally, but just progressive at saving energy. But they're also effective. They're not so complicated that they can't be properly implemented. And in Idaho, we recently went through zero-based regulation. So trying to minimize any language whatsoever dealing with regulation to make it a more to make the state more free of red tape. Any red tape. And that included looking at energy codes. So there was a moment where they were actually looking at striking all energy codes in Idaho. But the Division of Building Safety showed that, these are actually consumer protections, right? It's not necessarily structural. These buildings won't collapse, but they will impact health as well as economic well-being. One in five Idaho households could not afford a utility bill in the last month. That's a lot. That's 20% of the state. So we want to reduce construction costs so we can have affordable housing, but we don't want to just put up tin shacks where we are burdening the families that move into these cheap dwellings with very high unaffordable rates where they're having to forego groceries or medical bills in order to keep their home, heated or cooled.
Thank you for that. I know we've talked about this, but you're facing an ongoing and rapidly evolving circumstance, and you're meeting it with innovation and you're meeting it with integrated design approaches. How do you approach, maybe not clients or customers, but with the work that you do, how do you approach those conversations with pragmatism and saying, we can have both. We can have energy efficiency and economic efficiency and live better for it. What do those conversations look like?
Yeah, it's all about telling a good story. And for a good story, you need both truth and you need I'd say winsome graphics. So that's the beauty of the integrated design lab is integrating somebody like me with an engineering background along with an architectural perspective. So the way that we tell a story is to do the analysis. So we will create an energy model of a typical Idaho home based on construction data, and we will simulate what are the effects of these energy codes or energy code changes? How much is it going to save a family each year if they add, say, ceiling insulation to code levels? And then our architecture graduate students will take those numbers and create a very simple kind of one-page storybook, if you will, saying, okay, here's what a home looks like without an energy code, and here's what one looks like with the 2018 versus 2021 versus 2024 energy code, and how much are they saving for each of these different scenarios over, the mortgage lifespan of that building? And trying to put it, so trying to have the engineering rigor behind that modeling, and really good data, but then also conveying it in a very clear, simple, and effective manner. So that's what really we try to do. For example, we're working on a graphic right now on air sealing and looking at just the top 10 most effective places to seal a home during its construction. So it's a quick reference guide rather than a super long table with a lot of text, which at a certain point, for me anyway, looking at energy codes, even on the best of days, eventually my eyes glaze over, right? And so having thumbnail images and a couple of sentences about here's where that bead of caulk should go on this particular sill, I think makes it more effective and tells the clear story that we're trying to.
Yeah, and our work specifically ties in the non-energy benefits of these design decisions a lot. Do you oftentimes, with your guys's background in air quality or engineering or energy code, do you take that approach when you're talking to prospective project clients and say, you can do this and it'll be effective, plus, quality of life in this building might actually be better for it?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we face a lot in the Mountain West is increasing wildfire smoke, right? It's been a good summer so far. Fingers crossed that it stays good, but Boise's in a valley, and the smoke from surrounding areas often settles in there. And so we look at, okay, what are the energy benefits of a dedicated outdoor air system? Or bringing fresh air in rather than just recycling air through thin filters. What if you had better MERV 13 filters and only the ventilation air that you need rather than using a whole bunch of air for your heating and cooling, right? And so not only are you saving energy with a dedicated outdoor air system, but if you have a more effective filter, you are vastly improving the quality of life for the people inside that building, because when you do have a wildfire event, it's very easy to, filter that out, maybe close down the envelope where it might need to be. There's a great textbook that I use occasionally, and it's called A House Needs to Breathe, or Does It, by Allison Bales III. And there's this myth out there that we sometimes still hear during energy code discussions that a building should just be leaky, right? It should just almost be like Swiss cheese. It can naturally breathe. Well, if it's like Swiss cheese and if it can breathe naturally, that means all that smoke is coming in and there's no way to stop it. Or dust or, mold in the walls, that is going to just infiltrate the home, as opposed to a well-sealed home with well-designed ventilation, where you actually have a central filter. And doing so, having a well-sealed home, not only saves energy, it also improves the health of the occupants because you can filter out some of those particulates and potential even allergens as well, which I'm struggling with right now.
Same. Yeah. I say all the time, a lot of the decisions or conversations that we have in this energy efficiency, building operation, building performance world are oftentimes really circular around common sense. Like, you just have to understand the technicalities behind it all in order to make well-informed decisions. And, I think ultimately that is part of the purpose of the IDL network anymore. Do you want to
Yeah, so
talk
that,
about? Oh, go ahead.
yeah, just one other potential line in there is that the story of does a house need to breathe? The answer is no. The house doesn't need to breathe, but the people inside do. And so it's all about that occupant-focused design for both energy and health.
Yeah, and in the design and construction world, I feel like sometimes, as much sense as it would make, people oftentimes design a building that isn't occupiable, to your AI point earlier. Architecture can be very aesthetics focused and style focused, and interiors does look at human health, safety, and welfare, obviously. But I think people think about function of spaces and the use of spaces more so than they think about all of the things going on that actually do truly make that space occupiable and healthy.
Yeah, the first assignment I have my students do in their environmental control systems class is to just go into a room and just notice. Notice the airflow, the dust, the temperatures, the light, and to that's the point of architecture is to think through what is the occupant experience actually going to be like in this space, rather than just the beauty of it, which is incredibly important, right? But to design around all the factors of human thriving, which includes comfort and health.
Yeah, and we do a lot of work with occupant engagement. For example, folks at the payroll office here in Pullman obviously are not building science experts. They just show up and expect their building to do what they need it to do. And they do notice when things are off, but they may not know that a placement of a window or the placement of this duct that blows on me every single day does have implications for occupant comfort and satisfaction. And I'm always somebody that looks up and likes to understand what the guts of the building are doing and who maybe decided that one thing was better than another. But for your everyday building occupant, they may not have that expertise. And that makes making those decisions correctly even so more important, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. People are always upset when something goes wrong and rarely notice when it goes right, right? The idea of invisible design is you almost don't notice when it's working well, which is great because that's the whole idea. You want to free up brain space to focus on what you want to focus on. That could be payroll, that could be design, that could be reading. You don't want to spend all this extra mental energy figuring out if you need to put on that sweater or, close that vent or get that glare out of your eye, right? All of those things take away from our cognitive focus.
Yeah, and I think especially in the summer, we are chronically overconditioned here at WSU Pullman. It's 90 something degrees outside right now, and I'm trying to keep my hands in the neck of my work shirt so that my fingertips don't freeze. I am a cold person, naturally, obviously. You can relate to that, but making people's day even harder than they have to be is what we're trying to avoid. I was going to ask you next if you wanted to kind of talk about the purpose or the projects that you're working on right now, and maybe just share some big picture outcomes or ideas that you've been chewing on lately.
So just on the occupant experience and going in and noticing things, we've had the opportunity to do that through the governor's office, the Office of Energy and Mineral Resources, to go into rural communities. They have a program called Government Leading by Example to go into a building and identify, what potential energy efficiency upgrades would improve occupant health, performance, and reduce energy bills for these communities, which often, are strapped for resources. This often includes schools. There was a ProPublica series that came out last couple of years on the worst funded schools in America, and that was Idaho. An unfortunate claim to fame there. Thankfully, there's been a new initiative to improve a lot of these rural schools, but you have students and faculty who are aware that there are issues, but aren't necessarily sure where to start. And that's where we come in. So we will go in, we'll set up data loggers to measure temperature, humidity. We'll take in thermal cameras and look at the current systems that they have and where the opportunities for improvement are. Oftentimes they would love to switch to nicer windows, but that is going to be a massive budget increase. Whereas just adding insulation in the attic or ceiling is going to have a very quick return on investment and then make their systems operate a little bit longer, right? So we're looking for those sorts of opportunities. We're also working with a lot of our projects are funded through Idaho Power. Idaho Power is the largest utility in our state. They oversee the largest population, and they're our electric utility provider. And so we do a lot of outreach and education so that buildings don't get to that point, right? So that we educate on the front end. And we're not trying to be consultants. We're there just kind of to teach ourselves out of a job, to explore emerging technologies and how they might fit within Idaho's environment, both financially and then even just environmentally. Like, do we have the proper technology for heat pumps that can work in these cold climates? We do. But there's still hesitation out there. So it's a matter of engaging design professionals, both architecture and engineering firms, with things like lunch and learn series or lending out. We have close to 1,000 different tools for assessing the health of a building. We lend those out, or we provide, design consultation where we teach them how to, use a daylighting model, or walk them through an initial energy modeling cycle, even just with a simple box of looking at different orientations, different shading options, things that are going to dramatically impact the energy use and occupant comfort of that building, but are really hard to change later on. Once the building's in the ground, you're not about to change its orientation, right? So looking for those integration opportunities early on is something that we try to do.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're going and you're doing audits, you're doing common sense conversations with folks. You're also, to your point, way earlier in this conversation, I'm sure you're having to frame those in an economic sense of saying, hey, rural school district that has been operating out of a almost 100-year-old building for a really long time and is having comfort challenges. Here's your priority list of. And you're weighing those options and presenting them in a way that, a layperson could understand. And if they want to learn more, you're also that person. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Another project we had recently, which kind of highlights that approach, is we worked with the Idaho Army National Guard. They've got a few bases in Idaho, and they wanted not necessarily an energy efficiency list, but a resiliency list. Like, how do these buildings bounce back from a power outage or an outdoor air event, say wildfire smoke or some sort of adverse event, right? How do these buildings bounce back? And so we looked at several different building standards, right? We looked at LEED, we looked at the Living Building Challenge, we looked at Passive House, Green Globes, and then helped them develop kind of a very simple one-page bulleted list of here are your priorities. Like, really look at dedicated outdoor air systems. Make sure that when you are submitting a request for proposals, they are factoring in the lifetime of those energy bills, those utility bills, right? So that you can compare, so that at least they're thinking about it rather than just the initial construction costs, because it's so much more than that. They're going to be owning and operating these buildings for, the rest of those buildings' lifespans. So That was a very satisfying project to work on, because we know that one page list is now going to go out in all of their RFPs, and we also use the energy codes. The 2024 IECC has a new matrix for different building types and different climate types, and you overlay those, and it kind of gives you more points for using kind of the most energy efficient measure in different building types in different climates. And so we looked at their building types, we looked at their current climate zone, and we said, okay, here's where you should prioritize. It was a great design tool, but rather than having them go through that whole matrix or process, we were able to really simplify it down and then once again tell a very simple but effective and compelling story of how they might save energy and be more resilient. And they're not, a beacon of I'd say the green movement necessarily. They're interested in their bottom line and being resilient, but there's a perfect overlap between that and energy efficiency.
Yeah, and that brings up a really good point. I think you guys in U of I are a little bit more engaged with your state and local governments than, say, we are. Not, we have a lot of Washington State Energy Code things going on at the moment, I will say. But I think that conversation of framing what we do in these common sense environmental and sustainability and supposedly or so-called green movement conversations, framing it in the term of resiliency that there is a greater goal for this might be, and not to be a hater, but might be the way to appeal to more economically driven or environmentally skeptical kinds of folks. Would you say that that's true in your approach, or how do you handle the very, maybe not animus, but challenging climate in the state of Idaho when you're having these conversations? Is it just through resiliency? Is it through, like, how do you frame those, when it's not always going to be a fight, but there is some convincing to be done?
Absolutely. I'd say we primarily look at things through the frames of resiliency and economics. But most importantly, is not coming in with preconceived notions. And I have a hard time with that, right? I have learned that through energy audits. We will go into these small buildings, and the facility manager has no formal training or education, but they know that building inside and out. So we always go in just with an open ear, and we just start by listening. Tell us about the day-to-day in this building. Tell us the problems that you're having. Inside my head, I've got my own list of what I think they should be doing and how I think they should be operating their building, which might be radically different from how they are. But over time, I learn why they're doing things the way they are. And so we do the same thing from a codes perspective. We hear from folks that are struggling to either understand or implement a section or feel like it's too cost prohibitive. And we want to understand why. And then how can we make it more effective and work together? So starting our conversations by shutting up is usually a good way for us to go, where we just start listening to the issues that people are having and then working together on identifying a solution. And usually we can get there.
Yeah, and obviously, once you do get there, the numbers don't lie. You're able to prove through your energy models that this is a solution that will work for all of the facets of this problem that you're trying to solve. We talk to some of our industry folks and the mechanical contractors and our ESCOs all the time about how sustainability and like the change of maybe treating our buildings more like an important component of our environment is good business. Some of these facility managing companies or some of these new construction mechanical contractors who are all service, they realize that, a building owner does care about their bottom line. There is information to be learned about how and why they do things, not to say that they're misinformed, but they oftentimes have to approach it of saying, this is good business for you to operate this building better. And it's better for your portfolio to make sure that all of your buildings are running as optimally or as efficiently as possible. And I think Oftentimes, this is a conversation that's very politicized, and I obviously have my own notions to go with that as well. But I do think it's really refreshing, especially in the state of the world in our country at the moment, to know that there are reasonable conversations being had and that progress is being made despite all of the things that have been going on.
Absolutely. Yeah, at the end of my course, I always put up a slide, and on the one hand I've got Ayn Rand, and on the other hand I have got Henry David Thoreau with a little heart in between them. Like normally you would not think that those two would get along, but if you talk about energy efficiency, you can make both an economic and an environmental argument, and people love beauty and they love a building that works well that doesn't cost them a fortune, right? So there's a lot of ways to actually find common ground, collaboration between very disparate parties. And I love that aspect of the Integrated Design Lab, and it's one of the reasons that I really wanted to work here.
Yeah, and especially being in Idaho, you guys are surrounded by such amazing nature and such beauty and so many natural resources that I think the argument of making your building work with your environment instead of against it obviously has a lot of traction as well.
Absolutely.
Is there any other projects or kind of stories you feel are important to tell in the University of Idaho IDL sphere, or do you just want to start telling people where they can find you to get you to do some work for them? Because you do amazing, incredible things, and I think a lot of people could probably benefit from having a conversation with you.
Well, thanks, Shelby. I would mention one more project that we've been working on, and that's again kind of on the thermal side of things, but working with industry, actually. It's been a really productive partnership over the last 4 years, working with the company Hempitecture. And they have been. So, Hempitecture is a company that produces hemp insulation. And it's just out of the stocks of the plant. It's now legal to grow in Idaho. This isn't the fun stuff. This is more just like bamboo. This is jute, you know, that they're using for their buildings. And it went from them importing materials from Canada into the US to them building their own manufacturing plant in Idaho. And we were involved kind of through the whole progression of them developing their own manufacturing line. And we helped them do some research and development by doing thermal testing in our lab while they looked at different densities, different strains of these plants, how the fibers were crushed, how long they were left in the field, what sort of binders they were mixing in. And, you know, now they're manufacturing over 1 million pounds a year. They've got a lot of investment in it. It's not perfect for every application, but particularly for those interested in bio-based building materials and materials without formaldehyde, for anyone with health concerns, it's an incredible product. It also keeps its shape over time, and it's much easier to work with than fiberglass, which one of my graduate students called the devil's cotton candy. You know, this stuff smells more like hamster bedding. It's not bad at all. I don't mind having it in my lab. So that's been a real point of success for our lab, is to work with them and to see their company really thrive. And then it's led us into kind of other bio-based building materials. So we've recently wrapped up a National Science Foundation grant looking at 3D printing structures out of a combination of sawdust and sodium silicate, the binder that you have in cardboard, derived from Risol. So again, very bio-based, but how can we take advantage of, you know, rapid construction and the material resources we have in Idaho, a lot of forests, and turn that into a modern construction material that's very thermally insulating, as opposed to, say, concrete, which also has, coincidentally, very high carbon emissions.
Yeah, and obviously, to my point earlier about all of your wonderful natural resources, that is a common sense choice. You know, you can take something that you do have plentiful amounts of, although I know a lot of people, and we recently got into the mass timber world ourselves. So we've done a lot of research on the lobbying against mass timber from, concrete, big concrete. But it does make sense, taking things that are either byproducts from other industries and then repurposing them into buildings that make healthier buildings makes a lot of sense. So
It
thank you
does.
for making sure that you added that.
And it also supports, Idaho's industry. The Department of Commerce is thrilled with this. We have a new manufacturing plant, we've got new drivers, we have new farmers, all for this product that is being sought after, not just in Idaho, but around the country. And so I think it's a great success story.
Yeah, and this might end up being a sidebar or edited out, but I am kind of shocked to hear that Idaho is embracing a hemp product so strongly, in general. But I am glad to hear that. I've been interested in hemp insulation and hemp byproducts and hemp textiles specifically in the interiors world for some time now. So it is really cool to hear that that has moved forward and is making progress as a material.
It has, and it's all from, a business standpoint. They made the business case, and the Department of Commerce got behind it, and it's been a great success story.
Well, that's awesome for the state of Idaho. That's awesome for you. Where can people learn more about you? Where can they get in contact if they want to be one of your research assistants as a student, or if they are looking to come and work for the University of Idaho? How would somebody get in touch with you? Where can they learn more about your projects and your work? Do you have a website? Should they reach out to you on LinkedIn? Tell me more.
Yeah, the best place to find us is our website. And if you just Google U of I Integrated Design Lab, you will find us. Our website is idlboise.com. So it's pretty easy to remember. But yeah, just look us up, Integrated Design Lab in Boise, and you'll find us. I'm terrible at keeping up on LinkedIn or any social media. So if you want to email me, my email is dwoods@uidaho.edu, just DWOODS at uidaho.edu. But you can also find that on our website. So I'd say start at our website. You can see more of our programs, particularly if you're in Idaho Power Service territory, because we have a lot of ability to help customers there through their incentive programs. Additionally, we love to help with any education or outreach we can with throughout the state of Idaho. And so if you have a project in Idaho and want to run an idea by us, we start by listening. So reach out to us and we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, are you currently recruiting students at all, undergrad or graduate students or postdocs? And if somebody is listening to this and says, hey, that is actually very interesting, I'd love to get involved with this, should they be reaching out to you online or how would you prefer?
Reach out to us online. I have the good fortune of being at a lab that's just super cool. So I always have a long list of graduate students who would love to work here. So I'm not currently taking on any students. The more funding we have, the more students we can support. So that's why I spend my time on research and try to get new projects, is so that we can bring more students into our lab. The way we operate is, there's myself, and then we've got two other research scientists who are full time, and then we keep, two to seven graduate students around, depending on our funding. Right now, we just have a few, and I'd love to grow that in the future. And so, even if we don't have an opening right now, still reach out. I'd love to hear from any student, and if we do have an opening, I'll let them know.
Awesome. And then if I'm a building owner or somebody in the construction and design industry, and I have a question for you about my building or a building I'm working on or potential project, should I just reach out and get in touch?
Absolutely. Yeah, just go to our webpage, and if you go to About Us, you can see each of our different specialties. So mine would be mechanical. Dylan, his specialty is lighting, and then Farnaz looks at life cycle assessment and AI and data analysis. There's also just an intake form, especially if you're in Idaho Power Service territory. And we are a free helpline. please do reach out to us. You won't be billed. And we'd love to hear from you. And if it is a fairly large project, then we'll bring Idaho Power into that conversation and then develop a strategy to help your firm.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Damon. It's been a pleasure. It's always wonderful to learn a little bit more in depth, especially than I have the opportunity to whenever we meet each other in person at our NEA directors meetings. Do you have any closing wisdom or things you'd like to put out there for our audience to know more about you or the work that you do or your philosophy on efficient buildings?
Thanks, Shelby. I really appreciate this conversation. My closing thoughts, I would say the last year I have become very interested in just attention, the attention economy and how people attend to things in their life. And I was talking earlier about, the mental distraction that happens if we're uncomfortable in a space. I think it's wonderful to have the opportunity to pay attention to a beautiful, well-designed building, to walk into a space and to notice when it's functioning well, not just when it's functioning poorly. So for anybody listening in, just take time to notice your comfort, your breathing, the light in the space where you are right now, and in any future building that you might walk into or design. And if you're about to design a new building in Idaho, let us know. We'd love to help make that space as comfortable and beautiful as possible.
You can find Building Heroes on anywhere that you stream podcasts or music, including Apple, Google, Spotify, and you can find us on RSS. All of our companion documents are available to anybody who is listening on our website at idcl.wsu.edu /building-heroes-podcast.